WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
Six.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It has never been a Southern custom to dine out on a regular basis, but was that because there was a dearth of restaurants, or was the scarcity of restaurants due to the fact that we ate most of our meals at home? No matter. All of that is changing now, as we approach the annual Charlotte Restaurant Week, we're going to examine the evolution of eating out, and we have assembled a delicious panel to do so. When Helen Schwab began writing about food and restaurants in the pages of the Charlotte Observer, there weren't all that many choices. Today, I would bet she has a tough time covering them all, but she does, from tacos to tapas, foie gras to fries. Helen has seen firsthand the growth in Charlotte's food scene in the last 20 years, and she's joined us frequently on our food shows. Welcome back.
So happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Her daughter now works for us as an intern. And I promise not to embarrass her by bringing her in and asking if you ever cook at home.
Oh, yeah, that would not be a good plan.
Bruce Hensley is in the business of helping to promote the growth of dining out in restaurants. He and his wife Jill are the powers behind Charlotte Restaurant Week, the Queen's Feast, which starts tomorrow and runs through January 27th. It could be longer, Bruce.
I think it sort of dilute the concept. Some of the restaurants actually expand their restaurant week. In fact, we learned last night that Shima has already expanded theirs through January 31.
So it must work for them.
It must.
Okay. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Molly O'Neill is a nationally known author and food writer. She's written four cookbooks, including the New York Cookbook and One Big Table. She's a longtime food columnist with the New York Times Magazine and was the host of the PBS series Great Food. She is in our area to talk about an event that she's been organizing an event that she's done around the country and about which we spoke, I believe, the last time that you were here, A Place at the Table. You joined us by phone, but you're going to do this in Rock Hill. When?
It's this Saturday night. A Place at the Table is produced by the Friday Arts Group. Mm-hmm. And my group produces the Longhouse Food Revival, which is a one-time multimedia pop-up food magazine, a live magazine performance, followed by an incredible live fire feast.
What is a magazine performance?
Well, we just, you know, there's spoken word, there's video, there's slide, there's audio, there's live interviews, so that everyone in the audience is thrown into the middle of this diversity of media we have available to tell food stories. And It's just a whole lot of fun because you capture all of the creativity and craziness of a food magazine.
Wow.
And
plus you get to eat the food.
You get to eat a lot of the food. Much better than a test kitchen. Yeah.
And much better than a magazine.
There you go.
We'll talk more about that as we go through the show. And Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University, will be here. He helped put this panel together. By rights, he ought to be here, but he's caught in traffic. It's pretty nasty out there this morning. How much of the explosion in dining out, and I think arguably we have experienced an explosion in dining out since I've been here at least, and I came here in 85, has been due to the influx of newcomers, due to the, until the recession, influx of money into the economy, expendable income, the time constraints that modern life has provided in terms of having two people in the household who don't have time to cook dinner, say they'd rather go out, or the 1978 liquor by the drink law, which
that was the first thing I was going to say. 1978 liquor by the drink. Big, big, big difference.
Really?
Huge.
Why?
Because you could go out and have a drink then. It made a huge difference. Ask Gaston County, who took a while longer than Mecklenburg County to pass liquor by the drink.
And do restaurants make most of their money on the alcohol sales? Is that what it is?
Yep.
There's some significant margins in beverage sales.
Because I know that you've done a lecture on this, and you bring up liquor by the drink as being a watershed moment because it attracted big restaurants here. Chain restaurants could now come in, and they wouldn't come in prior to that.
There was one anomaly, that was Binnigan's, which happened to serve the first legal mixed drink. on November the 8th, 1978, at 8:04 a.m.
Maybe to Muggsy Bogues.
He used to hang out there. He knows the name of the customer. Who was the first person to buy a glass of whatever it was by the drink at 8:04 a.m.?
And what was it?
Hank Stoppelbein. I hope it was a Bloody Mary, because that's just too early for a martini. Maybe.
No time. It's so too early for a martini.
We know the date and time and the name of the person, but we don't know what he ordered?
No.
Criminal.
Let's say a Bloody Mary. That makes the most sense.
Criminal. With celery.
Now, when you breakfast. But, you know, you still can't buy a Bloody Mary at brunch on Sunday until noon, which makes no sense to me at all.
Helen, you're in church till noon, Mike.
Oh, excuse me. Helen, I must have made a mistake that day. I looked at the clock wrong.
That must be it.
You started writing food columns when?
88.
88. So what was the food scene like here then?
Well, I went back to the Mecklenburg County, some records that they keep, and asked number of restaurants per year. I did this a few years ago, and then I just got it updated yesterday by the wonderful Bill Hardister. And in 85, 86, which is the year, they count them in September. And these are a little bit rough numbers because you've got it. They carry, without getting into too much detail, this is sort of round numbers of how many restaurants. 851 in 85, 86. It took 14 years for that to double. So the 99-2000 year, it was right around 1,600. And September of 2012, 2,300. Again, round numbers because they don't allow for places that received a C status. They've got to carry those by law for a year. So the numbers are a little off, but not incredibly off. So that's a remarkable growth, I think. 14 years and then, you know, a very quick 7 or 8.
Are most of these ma and pa chef-driven or smaller restaurants versus chains?
It would be great to have that breakdown, and I don't know of anybody who has it. It's like restaurant failure. It's, you know, the last good study of that was 2007 or so in Ohio. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to do. It's hard to adjust for, you know, is a failure when the restaurant's sold? If it stays open, does that count as a failure? You know, is that a restaurant going out of business? So the stats are hard to get. If I had to guess, I would guess huge numbers of chain. Huge percentage of chain, particularly in Mecklenburg County.
And Bruce, you've been working. You have a company that works with restaurants in helping them promote themselves and you know, just get the word out. So tell me what the breakdown looks like to you from your point of view.
As far as failures?
No. As far as how many restaurants are here that are small, one-stop shops versus the Bennigans of the world, which I think are out of business.
Bennigans did leave here, and I don't know that breakdown either.
Too much early morning drinking.
Fortunately, we have a nice mix in Charlotte Restaurant Week, but I'd be wrong if I didn't admit that the chains help really drive the Restaurant Week and the big steakhouses. And Charlotte is still a meat and potatoes town, unfortunately, for a lot of us.
Well, I've noticed that a lot of the restaurants are steak restaurants. Is that, and I always just assume that's because for two things. People like steak, and also it's easy. It doesn't require some master chef in the kitchen necessarily, does it?
No, it's not chef-driven. It's meat and taters.
And something wrong with
I can't
potatoes.
Wait for the calls now.
Well, take this into consideration. Before the Great Recession of 2008, we had two Mortons, two Ruth's Chris, Palm, Sullivan's, Del Frisco's, Shima, Fleming's, and a litany of locally owned chop houses, mm-hmm. such as McIntosh's, which unfortunately has closed.
Right.
Beef and Bottle.
And I think the saddest story in my mind is the demise of a great, albeit a chain, was the Ocean Air Seafood Room, which elevated seafood in this town significantly. And people don't think twice about paying $35 for a filet mignon, but they're hard-pressed to pay the same price for a beautiful and more healthy piece of fish that was swimming off the coast of Hawaii yesterday.
Why?
I think it's our culture and in this market. And even as though lots of new people have moved in from across the country and across the world to Charlotte, it's still a meat and potatoes town.
Is that the case in a lot of cities around the country, Molly, that it's meat and potatoes, or are they willing to be more adventuresome?
You know, I'm surprised to hear this. I mean, I do see the meat and potatoes mentality, and I don't have a problem with it. I have my best meat out of the home. I would rather go out and have a perfect steak than cook it at home.
And explain that to me, because I think you can't even start with the perfect steak at home, because I think all the good meat has gone to the restaurants.
It's hard to get the great, it's hard to get the great meat. Uh-huh. In the summertime when I'm grilling outside, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, do I really want to put a big hunkin' piece of meat in a grill or the broiler or in a pan in a New York City apartment? No, I really don't. I don't want to live with the memory for the next
weeks.
Two of the main catapults in Charlotte's dining scene were steakhouses. The first, in April of 1987, was Longhorn Steaks at the corner of Euclid and Norwood.
I read that yesterday. That actually surprised me.
Oh, that was tremendous catapult.
Bigger than the ranch house on 74?
Absolutely. Because it's in the middle of town.
Okay.
And the people from the Duke Power, Bill Lee hung out there, Hugh McCall, Johnny Harris. If they weren't at their country clubs, they'd be at the Longhorn throwing back long neck beers.
And this was back in the Longhorn had peanut shells on the floor.
Peanut shells on the floor and country music on the jukebox. And then the first big national upscale chain was Morton's of Chicago in 1994. And that really served notice to the rest of the world and the rest of the industry that Charlotte was a viable target for restaurants.
Upscale steak places. So now, and then everyone came. All of them.
Yeah, 3 years later, Palm and
Peter. Well, they are lemming-like. They all use the same location spotters.
Yes,
And
you would think
that
you would just have flooded the market. And everyone that would open, I would say, okay, now we're saturated. We can't possibly sustain another one. And then the second Morton's opened.
And then you have two
miles apart.
A Palm and two Ruth's Chris Steakhouses and the Capitol Grill. Oh, really?
Fleming's, Sullivan's.
Yeah, that's a lot of steakhouses.
The biggest change that I've seen is this explosion of ethnically diverse restaurants that you have. It's unbelievable. The mom and pop restaurants. I've gone around with Tom Hanchett from the Levine Museum, and it's just mind-boggling to see this. You never used to see this kind of diversity except on either coast of the country, and now we're seeing it in the interior. My hometown of Columbus, Ohio, Charlotte. I mean, these places where you just never imagined that you'd get the best Vietnamese pho. Yesterday, I had lunch at La Cucina in East Charlotte. Amazing meal.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Rick Bayless, watch out.
Oh, really? Well, and some of it is that we've learned more as a dining community in Charlotte. Some of it is we are more comfortable now. When I wrote about the Dragon Inn, which was Chinese food, like Chinese was all we said. We didn't say regional. We didn't say anything. And you wrote about Americanized Chinese food in 1988. I mean, that's what Peking Palace and Dragon Inn and some of those places. Now we can talk about regional Chinese. Mm-hmm. Italian was open kitchen and with baklava for dessert, which is still open after 60 years and is an amazingly fun place. But now you've got Fiamma and you've got regional Italian at Luce and you've got just this plethora of choices. So I think part of it is sophistication in the dining community here and people who eat out. Part of it's we have a great Hispanic Latino community who has opened small, tiny Salvadorian places, and we have pupusas now, which we never had there.
They're amazing.
Absolutely.
Around here.
Yeah. They're really good.
We only have 30 seconds left in this segment, but Peter Reinhardt has arrived, and he's from Johnson to Wales. I'm just curious, before you guys arrived with your campus, we were told that when you got here and got up and running, our restaurants would get better because of it. How big a role has Johnson to Wales played in all of this?
I think we have played it, and not only our school, but all the culinary schools have played a great role, but we also told people when we got here, give us a few years, give our students and graduates a few years to get their legs under them, because it takes 5 years, say, from graduation for a culinarian to actually find his culinary voice.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our burgeoning food scene in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Environmental Window Solutions, offering climate seal magnetic window inserts for energy efficiency, comfort, and sound control, used in homes and businesses and for historic preservation. Details, environmentalwindow.com. Martin Luther King Jr. famously dreamed of a day when children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. We haven't quite reached that day yet, even with children themselves. And there is evidence, by the way, that children form attitudes about race as early as 6 months old. We're going to find out how to talk to kids about race with a researcher who has studied the social development of children and adolescents, and with the author of a children's book about race, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, air pollution across China is forcing authorities to cancel flights, close highways, and suspend work at some factories. The cost of growth in China.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for that conversation from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the growth in Charlotte's restaurant scene, and we'll get into a little history lesson with Bruce Hensley, who's with us in a minute or two. Bruce is the organizer of Charlotte Restaurant Week, which starts tomorrow and runs through the 27th of January. Helen Schwab, the restaurant critic for the Charlotte Observer and a frequent guest on our food programs, is back. Always a delight to have her here. Molly O'Neill, nationally known author and food writer, and is producing... I don't know what to call this. Is it A Place at the Table or the Longhouse Food Writers
Revival? It's both.
Okay, in Rock Hill.
A Place at the Table is being produced by the Friday Arts Group in Rock Hill.
And this is tomorrow?
It begins on Friday night with an art opening and continues throughout the day on Saturday.
This is on Main Street.
A great film on Friday night.
Great film.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Man Who Ate New Orleans.
Yeah. Yeah.
A must see.
Yeah.
And this is on Main Street in Rock Hill.
It is. And Saturday, late afternoon, we're producing the Longhouse Food Revival, which is a multimedia presentation about the food experience in America today.
Talk about the food, because you get around, Molly, and you were just talking off the air, I think, about several places that you've been since you've been in the Charlotte region. What factors around the country seem to impact dining out the most?
The economy. Mm-hmm. That's the great thing that people never talk about. We always mythologize and romanticize. Why are we eating out, and why are we not eating out? And it's the economy. During extremely flush times, cuisine historically has taken big leaps forward. And during times in which we pull back, cuisine also constricts, food media constricts, appetites change. People are looking for ballast. People are looking for economy. People are looking to be comforted more than sort of engaged and delighted by what they eat. So the economy definitely affects things. Americans like to say that they're affected by health concerns. Everybody is affected by health concerns in conversation. Whether or not it affects eating habits remains to be seen.
So true.
And can you be healthy if you eat a lot of meals out? Because there's a lot of extra sodium and fat in the foods in the restaurants because they make it, because we like it.
Yeah, yeah. The final thing that is so important and distinct about American restaurants is ethnicity and the constant shift with waves of immigrants. Restaurants are tradition. When I worked in restaurants, I ran kitchens that were like the United Nations. I had to be relatively conversant in three or four languages just to say, go wash the dishes, And these were entry-level positions, people learning skills that were sought after. And these same people, as they acquire skills, go on and create their own restaurants.
You haven't mentioned the word taste. People, are they looking for something that they can't do at home?
I think that people look for something that they can't do at home in restaurants, but I think more often than not, the big numbers in restaurants are driven by convenience and driven by, there are two people working at home and darn it, I'm just too tired and we're going to go out to eat tonight.
And we see proof of that in the incredibly explosive growth of the segment of the restaurant industry called QSR, quick service restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Is that fast food?
It's fast casual.
Fast casual food.
Fast casual is the better term.
Yeah.
And it defines a place where you can not only get food to go quickly and drive up, but also sit there and have a dining experience.
Yeah.
And that includes what all the restaurants we think of as fast food. But that's huge. That's grown so much in the last 20 years.
Gary on our website has a prediction. He says, as the world population continues to increase, rampant technology continues to eliminate more jobs and creates even fewer new jobs, and disposable income continues to decrease, we will see fewer and fewer people eating out. You think?
I disagree completely.
Yeah, that hasn't been the case in the
How do they pay the check?
But what I do think you'll see...
Part of that technology is going to be efficiencies in running restaurants as well. I mean, there are a lot of efficiencies you can do. You can't...
So the food will get cheaper?
Oh, no, the food will never get cheaper.
It never get cheaper. Of course not.
Silly you. And interestingly, I think Molly's exactly right when she says it's about convenience. I find in talking with people, it is rarely that they want something they can't get at home. Hmm. It is not. I mean, occasionally, and with steak in particular. I mean, I think that does fuel the high-end steakhouse clientele, because you can't get the meat and you can't cook it the way they cook it at home, and you can't reheat it.
But it's my personal experience. I eat out a lot, and I love eating in ethnic restaurants. But every once in a while, I really want something that could be cooked at home, like American food.
Sure.
And not just steak and potatoes. And that's hard to find, because everybody has dolled up their menus and fancied them up, or they cook Italian, or they cook Vietnamese, or they cook Thai. Nothing wrong with any of those. I like them all, but I mean,
what are you looking for with home cooking?
I don't know.
Burgers?
Chicken.
You want some fried chicken?
Not even fried chicken. You got a nice baked chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy.
Mm.
No one does that.
Oh, people do that.
Oh, yeah,
but there's not as big an appetite for that.
Right.
You're right.
I would think of something like, Whole Foods to go, and that is a huge growth sector in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest. I know
that.
We just
got our Whole
here
Foods.
Too.
So exciting.
Yeah, it's very, very exciting.
And that category has always been called home meal replacements.
Yeah. Right.
Where they are making the meals that you would normally make at home. You pick them up and take them home and put them out there. I think Boston Market sort of was the big player for a while.
Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
Chick-fil-A, whatever.
It's
interesting, too, to me that the economy, I think, again, you're right, has driven this sort of dichotomy of restaurants that in Charlotte in particular, high-end, lots of high-end, pretty expensive, and then more and more really inexpensive and very little in the middle. The complaint I hear most from diners is, where are the middle range restaurants?
Exactly.
Where is the middle range America?
Well,
I mean, restaurants are always an incredible mirror of what's going on economically and culturally. We are losing the middle class. Of course we're losing the middle range restaurants. We have these expense account, out of reach restaurants.
Right.
And we have these other ones that are one step away from taking food stamps, and there's nothing in the middle.
And that's why we have courses at colleges called Food and Culture, because food really is a mirror of culture.
I just assumed that was because you can't make enough money to pay the rent in these middle-income restaurants. You either have a hole in the wall where you serve really
quick. Well, that's part of it. I mean, that is part of it. And a lot of the smaller restaurants, some of their employee base is family, so they don't have in the economy, as the economy declines, you're not losing employees because they're your family. They have to work there even no matter how well you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I've talked with owners who have said that's where the middle range really gets hurt in the economy is it's a very, very thin profit margin to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start closing that up, that you do lose that. A lot of people thought we'll lose all our high end. And we lost little of our high end restaurants in Charlotte. I mean, we lost some, but we didn't lose a lot because typically they are capitalized by large chains.
Right.
I mean, who have done research about what's going to work before they get here.
And the upper income people were not as affected by the recession, perhaps, as the middle and lower income people were. Bruce Hensley, who is the organizer of Charlotte Restaurant Week, has conducted a little history survey of the history of restaurants in Charlotte. How far back did you go?
To the early 1900s, because there wasn't much of a restaurant scene before that, you know, due to Charlotte not being a resort town and a mountain or coastal destination and not being on a port or a river and, frankly, not having a very significant railroad presence in the early 1900s.
And the population was small.
Charlotte, in the early 1900s, had a population of about 18,000 and was not even the largest city in North Carolina. Wilmington was. And most of the restaurants, all of the restaurants, were confined to the uptown area in hotels and the train station and even the bus station later on.
And who patronized these restaurants?
These were primarily the textile moguls as families on special occasions. You know, we had a big textile presence back then and electric presence, and so they were
plus there wasn't the business I alluded to this at the beginning, and I think I'm right, and if I'm not, you'll tell me, that there has not been a real tradition in the South, in rural areas, and Charlotte, arguably in the early 1900s, was still fairly rural, because when you left the downtown area, you were in the country.
Myers Park was in the country.
Yeah. Didn't have a tradition of eating out. You ate at home.
Right.
So unlike New York City, which had been a city for a very long time, we didn't have a lot of restaurants and not a lot of tradition of eating out. What made people eventually take that step? Do you know?
Population growth, a more significant railroad presence. The airport certainly helped. It was a slow, methodical growth. And as we discussed, there were several catapults, and the liquor by the drink referendum passing in 78 was certainly one of them.
As best as I can determine sitting here looking at you, you were not around when places like the Gem, Grisham's, the Buford and Selwyn Hotels,
the Cardinal,
Ming Tree were around. Can you tell from your research, because these were the names back then.
Correct.
Can you tell from your research if they were any good by their standards or our standards today?
Word of mouth and some written word, yes. And a lot of them would serve roast squab, roast rabbit, roast chicken, even roast quail, frankly, thanks to a local hunter, perhaps. And veal dishes were particularly prized at the Cardinal, I understand. The El Morocco Supper Club, which opened in 1949 on Wilkinson Boulevard, brought nightlife to town. And they had a fancy restaurant, too.
On Wilkinson Boulevard.
El Morocco.
But wasn't that pretty far out?
It was. Then? It was indeed.
Of course, you couldn't have it downtown. That would just be wrong.
How much do you think that the demise of household help fed people leaving the home? In the Northeast, it was pretty – there was a pretty clear correlation between people who had household staffs, and then as fewer and fewer people had staffs at home, more and more of them were eating out on a regular basis, using restaurants to entertain.
We haven't gotten to that episode yet on Downton Abbey. So we don't know the answer.
And I don't know the answer.
You know it's coming, though.
And the other question would be when people began to come – my question for Bruce would be when people began to come from places like Greece into Charlotte, who had a strong restaurant culture.
Yes.
I would think in the 1913, 14 on up, that was a huge piece.
It was. And it was usually Greece via New York.
Right.
Or Italy via New York.
Right.
Huh. You reference a guy that I knew who was a terrific guy, Slug Claiborne, who opened – he ran the Barclays Cafeteria on East Independence, and then he opened Slug's Rib, and he opened Slug's Choice, and he opened Slug's 30th Edition, which was the place to go for a very long time because it was on the 30th floor, the top floor of a skyscraper downtown. You say he arguably did more for the development of fine dining in this region, not just Charlotte, than anybody else.
Nothing says quite Slug. I mean, that just embodies fine dining.
Yes, but when I moved to town, that's what intrigued me. I thought, why would you go to a place named Slug? It must be great.
Slug's Rib on Independence Boulevard
had
the very first salad bar in North Carolina. And consequently, the first sneeze guard, I presume.
They weren't mandated by law.
At one point, Slug had 15 restaurants throughout the state. Wilmington, Myrtle Beach, Asheville, Winston-Salem, Charlotte. He was a huge catalyst to the fine dining. And not only Charlotte, but the whole region.
Did they all go away when he went away?
They did. He just died last March.
Oh, no.
He passed away.
The Slug Empire?
Yes. Yeah. It sort of started dwindling in the 90s when Slug was slowing down, and a lot of these big chains came into town and sort of squeezed out the local guy. And
Slugs are relatively slow normally. Barclays Cafeteria, that was a phenomenon.
It was.
What was special about that? Because a lot of the Broadway, back then, Ovens Auditorium, which was right down the street, was the place all of the touring shows came in, and all of the, you know, even whether it was a Broadway show or a one-night shot for a singer or something, they would eat there at Barclays Cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Is that because that was the only place to go, or was it really good?
Well, it was locally owned.
It was a cafeteria.
It was a cafeteria, and he took advantage of the S&W, K&W mold, and he was local. And Independence Boulevard was a great location. That was a major thoroughfare that wasn't anything like what it is today. It's an expressway today. That was like the South Boulevard or North Tryon Street of the 50s and 60s. And he had a great personality, and he was well-connected, and he was a great PR man, and Slug just knew how to work it. And it was just as much of his personality that pulled folks in as the food. Mm. And the location always helped. You're there beside the ovens and the Coliseum.
Is there a Slug Claiborne around today on the restaurant scene?
Wow.
Some mini slugs, maybe.
Yeah.
People who were newcomers and just tuning in, I can imagine what they're thinking.
There are significant restaurateurs in this town, and one that really flies under the radar is Dennis Thompson. And this town has no idea what Dennis Thompson has meant to the restaurant scene here. He was the one that brought Dean and DeLuca here. He was a founder of Lone Star Steaks, which is now Del Frisco's and Sullivan's, that company. He is a partner with Frank Schiavelli in a couple concepts, Cantina 1511, which they recently sold the majority part of, Midwood Steakhouse, Paco's Tacos, Bad Daddy's Burgers, and then Schiavelli also has Mama Ricotta's. Mm-hmm. And Dennis was the founder of Fox and Hound, of Bailey's, of Firebirds. I mean, he's just got a phenomenal track record.
He knows what works in Charlotte.
He does.
What does work, aside from meat and potatoes?
I like chef-driven, locally owned, quaint restaurants that are slightly upscale, and I think we have a nice selection of those. Augusto Conte does a great job. He's got five concepts in Charlotte, including Luce, which Helen referred to earlier. And he would be a mini slug.
So he has Luce. He has the, I don't know the name of the place, but it's right down the alley.
Malabar.
Malabar.
Yeah,
it's called Malabar. It's Spanish
kind of
now.
It's kind of a
tapas place.
Really, Mezzanotte.
Really nice. Mezzanotte is his little pizza place at Sharon Amity, near in Cotswold. Mm-hmm.
And I think
Trattoria Antica. I always mess that up.
See, I used to love Il Posto, which he owned too, and for Phillips some reason place. He turned that into what, Malabar? Oh, that's Phillips Place.
No, Il Posto was the one at Phillips Place.
And there was another one just like it at where Malabar is now.
Well, that was Coco, somewhat similar. Yeah. He does well. He does really well at figuring out what the market in the particular place. He doesn't just carbon copy them and stick them in. He does something different. So his place in Waxhaw is more simple, does more simple things and less expensive things.
And
in Waxhaw, that's really a nice draw for that area because they don't have a lot and they have to drive 25 minutes, 30 minutes to get to Charlotte.
And he understands about pasta, the power of pasta, which is, I mean, if you look at the most successful restaurant concepts around the United States, historically, at least for the last 50 years or so, it's always Italian, Mediterranean, because that's a comfort food that everybody can relate to. So that's usually a formula for success if you can execute it well. And he's one of the guys who figured that out. I think the Harper's Group is another good example of a group that has this multiple restaurants with interesting themes. I love Zinc, and Upstream's done well. And Harper's itself is a great example that has spun off to like 131 Main.
And Harper's is one of the few that...
We have to stop. You must stop.
It's food. It's driving us.
I know it. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art's The Game of Modern Love, celebrating the enduring partnership of artistic twosomes with cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, live music, and more. February 15th at 7. Details and tickets at Beckler.org. And CPCC Corporate and Continuing Education announcing open enrollment for spring classes to advance professional careers through short-term certificate courses. Registration at cpcc.edu/ccc. Air pollution across China is forcing authorities to cancel flights, close highways, and suspend work at some factories. Guest host Tom Jelton of NPR and his guests will explore the cost of growth in China on the Diane Rehm Show in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you love food, check out our food blog at WFAEats.org. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323.
Hi, I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We're music critics and the hosts of Sound Opinions, and we're psyched to be joining you in Charlotte.
Tune in each week as we bring you the latest music news, record reviews, and artist interviews. Join in on the rock and roll debate Fridays at 11 p.m. on Charlotte's NPR news source, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the evolution of dining out in Charlotte with Bruce Hensley, organizer of Charlotte Restaurant Week. The Queen's Feast begins tomorrow, runs through January 27th here in Charlotte. Molly O'Neill is a nationally known food writer and author and producer of A Place at the Table in the Longhouse Food Writers Revival, which is taking place Friday night and Saturday on Main Street in Rock Hill. Where can you get more information about where that is and how to get involved?
You can go to www.cookandscribble.com.
Cook the letter N, scribble.
That's it.
And we'll have that on our website at WFAE.org. Helen Schwab is also here with the Charlotte Observer, and of course, Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University. Those of us who live in mid-sized cities figure that everything that we get on the dining scene comes from a bigger place. It's tested, it works, it moves, looking for a new group of people. But you say, Molly, that small ethnic restaurants are the predictors of large trends, and if we want to know what New York City will be doing 5 years from now, sample the restaurants in East Charlotte. Really?
Well, I think that East Charlotte is a pretty remarkable mix and a really vibrant predictor of what we'll be doing in highly upscale restaurants and the sort of citadels of cuisine. There's a constant exchange between arriving populations and established populations and then restaurants and chefs who are taking these arriving concepts. Let's look at a pupusa. I expect that we'll be seeing pupusas becoming, you know.
What is that?
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful little, almost like a stuffed pizza that's
but
small.
Usually with cornmeal. It's like a pouch.
You make a
pupusa
one.
Is a pouch.
Yeah.
It's sometimes called an arepa.
Mm-hmm. They're sold by pupuserias.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And you'll see now food trucks are getting them out there. So now the country, who never heard of pupusas, is seeing them in non-ethnic areas because of these food trucks and small restaurants that are getting foods like that are just bursting with flavor. That's what it comes down to.
And endlessly adaptable. And so why would it be the moment for – why is it the pupusa moment? Well, it can be made out of a gluten-free flour.
Mm.
The gluten intolerance is becoming a reigning health concern. It's so adaptable. You can stuff those suckers with anything. You know, they can have barbecue in them, the chorizo in them. They can have a salad in them. They can have cheese in them. They can have spice in them. They can have nothing in them. And they're smaller. And portion size is becoming of great concern to the upper end of the restaurant dining out population.
They want to make things smaller?
Mm-hmm.
Is that because they're looking out for our health, or they want to make them they want to have less investment in it?
Probably both.
Both.
Well, and the
both.
Clientele wants. I mean, it's more portion conscious.
They're inexpensive. You can get two or three of them if you want more. You can make them part of a larger meal.
And they're portable. And throughout American history, portability has been a really big thing.
Grab, gobble, and go.
There you go. There you go. 18th century visitor from Europe to New York City described it as a city and a nation of people who grab, gobble, and go. They never stop.
Wow.
Well, that was said
We're
in
so
the 18th
proud.
Century. Grab, gobble, and go.
Yeah.
See, how about that?
Where was McDonald's then? You mentioned one of the trends that we've been seeing around the country, more gluten-free materials or things on the menu. And you say the other trends include local, which we've talked about on this program, organic. We've talked about gluten-free. What's the next trend?
I don't have my crystal ball this morning. It's really early and it's raining out.
I think it was you. I read an article that you wrote, and raw is one of the things.
I think that raw is a very important kind of sub-trend.
Raw what?
Raw veg. Well, mostly raw vegetables. But
uncooked foods.
It's a way
alive, technically.
Yeah. Live food. So that it's the antithesis of overprocessed food. It's the antithesis of the French fry that's made ahead and held under a heat lamp. It has to prove that the actual ingredients have flavor. We've become intensely judgmental and puritanical about the nature of our ingredients and the chain of custody. You know, where did they come from? Mm-hmm. Who handled them? How am I getting them? Why am I paying $5 for a single mesclun leaf on my salad? And
why indeed?
You know, getting it as a piece of raw ingredient is sort of a proof of how great the actual ingredient is. We're looking at a lot of ingredient-driven cuisine right now. And then there's also, you know, a sort of rising raw foods movement in the health-minded sector.
Yeah.
And there are always collisions between these whacked-out trends on the lunatic fringe, and they're constantly moving toward the center.
Yeah.
And more people, I think, are willing to pay more. You know, Europeans pay a much huger percentage of their income for food. We pay typically, I don't know what the percentage is, but it is infinitesimal compared to other cultures who care more about the qualities of their food and on a range of levels. And we like big, cheap, fast. The cheaper,
well,
the better.
Our farms
and
have,
that's changing a little bit, I think.
Our farms have traditionally been on welfare. And we've had artificially supported cheaper food. And there was a wonderful article this week in the Times that the Longhouse co-producer was telling me about, of the younger people and the percentage of their income. First it's rent and then it's food. Now that's a historic change.
It's really shifting.
To be putting that much of your earning power into your food. And I think that we're going to see more and more of that. I mean, the cynic in me thinks that the whole explosion of food consciousness and the chef is rock star, and that if we could pull away and look at this 50 years from now, we'd be looking at a gigantic marketing campaign that's getting America ready and willing to pay more for food.
Are you writing this down, Bruce?
I am indeed.
And Mike, I'd like to go back to that original question you asked of what's coming next. Yeah. And I think that we sort of addressed it earlier. If you look in the ethnic neighborhoods, if you look in the communities where something exciting is happening that hasn't tipped over yet, that's what restaurateurs do. They look at those communities. They can sense it. And sometimes you can feel it as it's coming. Who would have thought that ramen noodles would become one of the most influential foods of the last 10 years? But it took a great chef in New York, David Chang, to kind of elevate that. And now we haven't even begun to see all the manifestations of how that's going to impact restaurants.
But what has played out in Charlotte is tacos.
Right.
Street tacos.
Right.
That is a huge thing that people have figured out how to do in a chefly way.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To charge more, but not prohibitively more. I mean, that's a place where Charlotte restaurateurs have been really smart, picking up from East Charlotte, because you can go to East Charlotte and get them for $1.50. Mm-hmm. And you're paying $6, but that's still affordable on the scheme of things for Charlatans who are interested in bold new flavors and changeable things and things you can put anything in.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of phone calls here from people who've been holding on for a while. We'll begin with Tema in Charlotte. Welcome.
Hi.
I
eat out all the time because I leave work about 7:30, and I moved here from New York about 20 years ago, And what I miss the most in Charlotte are the Greek coffee shops. What if you want to just go in and get a great grilled cheese sandwich?
Grilled cheese is coming back, girl.
Yeah, I hope so. It is. You don't always want to sit down for a big, expensive meal, which we have plenty of in Charlotte.
Well, humorously, now we've got a food truck. Here are the ends of the spectrum. We've got a food truck called Papi Queso, specializing in grilled cheese. And guess who else is serving grilled cheese?
That's uptown, right?
Pardon?
That's uptown, probably.
Well, they. You know what? If you track them, if you go to Twitter, Papi Queso will, and all the food trucks will tweet their locations daily, so you can figure out where they are. Some of them mapped as well. The other end of that, the Ritz-Carlton just started serving grilled cheese. Yeah, totally not
$35.
No. You know, honestly, they're $4.50 to $6.50. I just blogged about it. You know, but
not quite the same.
But it isn't quite the same. You're right.
But you know, we saw grilled cheese coming maybe 10 years ago, and it takes that long sometimes for things to hit in Charlotte.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes things start here but don't explode here, and someone else picks them up. But grilled cheese has been coming for a while, and we've been predicting that one.
That's just a metaphor. I mean, the neighborhood coffee shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Neighborhood
right.
coffee shop.
And not Starbucks. I'm not talking about Starbucks.
I know precisely what you're talking
about.
Thank you for, your call.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
I can
Bye.
Tell you, who again, as we spoke earlier about QSR, these quick service fast casual restaurants. Panera is an example of a company that saw that need and filled it on a national level. It's not the same as having your own local little place where you know the owners and everything.
No, it's not the same.
But they understood that that's what people craved, and that's how they built their business model.
Some people say that in Charlotte there is no there, but in this case of this call there is, because this is Charlotte, in Charlotte.
All right.
Welcome. Hello, Charlotte. Oh, we pushed the button. I did push the button. Speak to us, Charlotte.
Okay, hello. How is everybody?
Good.
Hey, Charlotte.
I just wanted to ask a little off topic here, but about the environmental impact of eating out and what some restaurants in town might be doing to kind of curb that.
Charlotte, are you my styrofoam person?
I am.
Stop styrofoam. Charlotte
right.
has an interesting platform through which she is trying to convince restaurants more and more to stop using styrofoam and to use recyclable to-go containers, to encourage people to bring their own to-go containers. Have I missed anything, Charlotte?
Yeah, no, it really is. Just take your own
and then get a discount for it. Be rewarded for that. Don't have to, but if they would. I'm looking at the faces in the studio.
So
who are
bring your own casserole dish. If you know you're going to someplace, you're going to take stuff home. Okay.
No, and I think that's happening. I think that you and many others are having that impact, but it happens like piece by piece.
Slowly.
It takes a while for it to tip over, but it's infiltrating the restaurant consciousness, I think.
Charlotte, maybe you could give your website to somebody and we could put it up. If people are interested,
off the air.
I'll put you back on hold, and our producer will pick up and we'll get your information off the air.
Okay, excellent. Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, and we'll put it on our website at WFAE.org. Princess on Facebook writes, as a pescatarian, for sustainability reasons, I found it difficult to go out. Either fish isn't on the menu, or it's really expensive, or even more annoying, I go to a nice place and the server doesn't know where the fish came from. Mm. Second point, does
this Portlandia. Yeah, wait.
Second point,
does the fish have friends?
Does the panel recommend any restaurants for the locavore?
Are you into raw? Well, no, wait. Okay, pescatarian. You're probably going to do better in that middle range of places like, I'm trying to think if Malabar has fish on the menu. I mean, you're right in that it does tend to be expensive here. You know, we're not on the coast, so if you are looking for fresh and you're looking for provenance, McCormick and Schmick will tell you exactly where every single thing came off the boat. But it's not cheap.
No. Lee on Twitter says, I know it sounds crazy, but I want a healthy fast food drive-through restaurant, and I don't mean apples at McDonald's. Kia on Facebook, in answer to Princess, there are lots of Charlotte restaurants offering locally sourced fare. Harvest Moon Grill, Halcyon, Great Fish, and they'll even tell you the Fisherman. Fern flavors from the earth.
And I'll throw in, you know, the pizza world. You know, we're doing it at Pure Pizza. The whole market, the 7th Street Public Market, is a place to go for that kind of connection to the food.
Sean in Dilworth emails, could you please ask why Charlotte lacks the James Beard Award? Atlanta, Charleston, Raleigh, Asheville do. Is Charlotte meat and potatoes because it is a mostly business town that it isn't a vacation destination? So there's two questions there.
That's like a whole show.
Okay. Mike, it
tomorrow.
Says, Leslie
let's do a show on
the web writes, Mike, if you're looking for a great home meal dining experience, please visit Aaron's Restaurant in Rock Hill, located on Caldwell Street downtown. Her menu items are sources from local farmers and made fresh in her kitchen daily. She is known for her not so typical Southern collard greens, and her meatloaf is wonderful.
Can I mention one place? People who wanted to talk about history, Pat Richardson does something called charlotteeats.blogspot.com that has these incredible historical pictures of restaurants in Charlotte and menus and ads. And we can probably get that on your website. Really fun to browse if you're of that mind.
I ate at a very tasty Vietnamese restaurant in Rock Hill last night called Tease on Main Street. All right, Restaurant Week starts. Charlotte Restaurant Week, the Queen's Feast, starts tomorrow, runs to the 27th of January. How many restaurants are participating this year?
We have a record 112 restaurants in a 6-county area.
And what does that mean to the diner?
It means we have a lot of great choices and a big geographic footprint. And it gives over 130,000 diners, which is what participated in July, the opportunity to get outside of their normal geographic and economic footprint and go try stuff. I mean, we do it in late July and late January because the restaurants are slow then, and it gives them the coveted trial business, and it gives them cash flow, and it keeps their staff working, and it gives the public a fantastic deal.
Have restaurants found that people who discovered them because of Restaurant Week come back when the food is when the prices are different?
The living social question.
Indeed, and the restaurateurs tell us, we post survey every participant after each Restaurant Week. And they say on average they see 75% new faces in their restaurants during Restaurant Week. And we've added a hotel component this time. I'd be remiss not mentioning that. Uptown Charlotte, South Park, and Ballantyne. And we're trying to make this a true tourist destination to get people from Shelby and Statesville and Salisbury and your listening footprint to come in and spend the night in Charlotte during Restaurant Week and go to shows and museums or spa treatments or golf or whatever and really enjoy the whole city. And Restaurant Week is a good time to do that.
And you can go to Rock Hill this weekend and enjoy the Longhouse Food Writers Revival with Molly O'Neill. Information about that is on our website at WFAE.org. Begins tomorrow night at what time?
Yes. Begins tomorrow night at 6 o'clock in Rock Hill with an art opening and the airing of an amazing film that Peter's a great fan of as well.
And all day Saturday. I'll be there.
And Saturday night.
Molly O'Neill, a writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of several cookbooks. Helen Schwab, restaurant critic for the Charlotte Observer. Bruce Hensley, organizer of Charlotte Restaurant Week, the Queen's Feast, beginning tomorrow. And Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University. Thank you all.